Welcome back, everybody, to Neutrality Studies. Today, with the one and only Professor Glenn Deason. You've had a couple of guests on your show, which are quite incredible. One of them, of course, being Mr. Professor Karaganov from Russia, like one of the foreign policy hawks of Russia, but one of the very important ones. You regularly have John Mearsheimer on your podcast and Jeffrey Sachs. And it seems to me as if though the alarm bells should be ringing in every single capital in Europe at the moment, but they don't. What are you making out of the very like live IR updates that you're getting from everybody?
Well, my main concern now is that we're a bit like the frog boiling in the water here, because NATO, we often pursue this incrementalism. We gradually do things instead of doing these big steps, which creates a large reaction. I often use the example of a missile defense, because in this one, I remember in the mid-2000s, they were mocking kind of the Russians, going, listen, we're only going to put 10 interceptor missiles in Poland. There's no way this can threaten the Russians. It's ridiculous. But, you know, at the same time, you heard in these think tanks, they were saying, well, we start with 10, put in a system, and then we gradually expand it, and then suddenly those 10 became several hundred, and then this is kind of how the incrementalism work. And we do the same in the Ukraine war. We began sending ammunitions. I remember the javelins, which Trump said was seen as problematic. We had gradually some tanks, artillery systems, HIMARS. I always use the example of Joe Biden making the point that we can't send F-16s. That would mean World War III. If you repeat this today, you would be spreading Russian propaganda. You'd be told that, of course, we're just helping this. You can't possibly escalate by helping, you know, even though most European countries didn't send weapons to countries at war, exactly because it would make us participants. This was the common sense. This was the consensus. This was logic. These days, you're not even allowed to say it without being smeared. So we've gone this by doing this incrementalism, small steps at a time. I don't think we realize how far we have gone, because now, of course, we are deeply involved in attacking Russia. And I made this point last year when with this long-range strikes, where the weapons are supplied by us. The war planners, they direct the goals. We have our politicians standing there saying, well, our goal should be to do deep strikes in Russia, destroy its energy infrastructure. You have the intelligence being picked by our intelligence services. They're doing the targeting. Our satellites are guiding the missiles. So we are deeply involved in every way. This is no longer even you mentioned John Mearsheimer. I refer to it as a proxy war, and he said, Glenn, really, we kind of move beyond proxy war. NATO is now attacking Russia directly. And of course, the last step now, which we see, is this new incrementalism, which is the Russians say, oh, well, the drones are now attacking the Baltic region of Russia, the Baltic coast, where a large part of Russian oil is exported. And it goes through the Baltic states, their territory. Given the distance, it's very likely that they're even launched from the Baltic states. And first they deny it. No, this isn't happening. And then, of course, they say, oh, yes, it is happening, but we did not permit the Ukrainians from using this territory. And also, it's kind of the Russians' fault, because the drones wouldn't be there if it wasn't for Russia's, unprovoked attack. And then now we're moving to seeing the Swedish prime minister saying, listen, if the drones are crashing in NATO countries, we should at least help direct them in the right direction towards Russia. So, it was a slow, same with the long-range strikes. First, we're not going to give long-range weapons. Okay, we are going to give them, but we're going to put restrictions on what they're allowed to use them for. And then gradually the restrictions are removed. So we are the boiling frog now, and we have attacked Russia, and the Russians have now reached the conclusion that this can't continue. It's time to strike back and retaliate.
Yeah, and I mean, the horrible thing is that Mr. Karaganov, I mean, in his interview with you, he said that he used to be the lone voice in the wilderness who said, like, we need to strike Europe. And by now, he seems to have quite a lot of support within the policymaking world of Russia, but also within the general population. And if I listen to what I hear from our colleague Stas Krapivnik, he says the same. I mean, the Russians are just fed up with being constantly made targets, and then the Europeans are hiding behind, like, we are not part of the war, when they do all of these things and do them out in the open. And over the weekend, we are talking today on Monday, 25th of May, over the weekend actually, or on Friday, the Ukrainian side attacked actually a school, a college dorm in Lugansk, and killed 21 students there. The Ukrainians are saying it was a drone, a school for drone pilots, which would be like the dumbest place on earth to put a drone pilot school to. Russia is of course saying, like, no, this was a teacher and a pedagogic school teaching future teachers that now died. And Europe is actually pretending that this is another one of these things that never happened, and that the retaliation that came through Oreshnik strikes and other missile systems was absolutely unprovoked. I mean, Kaya Kallas today published this, another one of these, of her insane tweets. And it's just like the whole logic of it. Russia hit a dead end on the battlefield, so it terrorizes Ukraine with deliberate strikes on city centers. These are abhorrent acts, terror meant to kill as many civilians as possible. Moscow reportedly using Oreshnik intermediate range ballistic missile system designed to carry nuclear warheads is a political scare tactic and reckless nuclear brinkmanship. She says at the same time that these are devastating weapons and that they try to kill as many Ukrainians as possible, yet we know they killed four people in Kiev. It's like, how is it possible that these people put out such tweets and do not understand that what you're doing is you're just bringing the Russians closer and closer to actually do something very drastic? Do you think this is on purpose? Are they baiting Russia again to basically enlarge the war the way it was enlarged in 2022, or is it utter ignorance for you know, the actual battlefield dynamic at the moment?
Well, this is the continuation of the unprovoked narrative, where suddenly, oh, how could the Russians possibly do this? It came out of nowhere. And if, you know, like you would come introduce some common sense, well, actually, this didn't come out of nowhere. It was very much provoked, and they always have the same logic. Well, that means you're then legitimizing and supporting the Russian strikes. In other words, you know, you are with the Russians, and now any personal attack on you is opened. You're an apologist for Putin, and no one should ever listen to you. So we criminalized all dissent. These leaders can say any nonsense they want, and there will be no dissent at all, because their whole argument is everything is unprovoked. If you say it's unprovoked, that means you're backing the enemy, essentially. So this is the narrative we have stuck ourselves in, which is why the water keeps boiling, you know, for our little frog here. But you're right with the condemnation. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, why wouldn't they condemn the killing of all of these students in Lugansk? Why they struck the school, and then afterwards they condemn the retaliation? You know, when you're only able to condemn one side, well, what are you doing then? Is this based on principles of human rights, or is this just cheerleading? So whatever the enemy does is evil, and whatever our side does is it doesn't matter. Condemnations means nothing at all when there's no principles. And as I said, they keep referring to genocide of Ukrainians, efforts to kill as many as possible. How can you strike with 600 missiles and drones, and then four people are killed, and the goal was to create as much death as possible? If you strike a massive city like Kiev and the goal is to kill as many as possible, and you have 600 missiles and drones at your disposal, then either the Russians are very ineffective, or as is obvious, this is all nonsense. It's just fueling hatred of the Russians and pushing war. That's all.
The mind-boggling thing is just that this is coming at the same time. I mean, the Europeans are accusing Russia of genocidal intent at the same time as they are the greatest cheerleaders of Israel's genocide in Gaza, right? Where you actually have tens of hundreds of thousands dead in a concentration camp that's being made smaller and smaller by the day. And it comes at the same time when the same European leaders also were, you know, full of praise for the US-Israeli war of aggression against Iran, and even backed them. And I think this is where this is coming from, backed them at the United Nations when then it was Iran that was condemned for striking back at the Gulf states. And the European leaders kept saying that the Iran is unprovokedly like attacking and enlarging the war in its neighborhood. And is it? My theory is that they used to be able to do that. This is how Europe did its foreign policy or its jargon and its way of going about business for the last 500 years. And they just agenda setting. And that's what's not working anymore. I mean, or then again, I just can't look at the Cold War and think that people back then already did such irresponsible things. Do you think it changed in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I think that was one of the curses of the unipolar moment. That is when all power was concentrated in the West. That is, I belong to the realist school of political theory, and in my view, states do not constrain themselves. And this is the problem. If there's no constraint, well, what did key realists like Stephen Waltz say after the Cold War? He said, the main problem now is how will the U.S. constrain itself? We can do whatever we want now. We can start war everywhere. We can expand military blocks. There's no constraint, and we don't constrain ourselves. That's what the states don't do. So now we're going to engage in a lot of horror. And over time, the predictable thing is that the U.S. would exhaust itself and increasingly balance. And when I say exhaust, it's not just the military potential, which is being exhausted, but it's also the reputation. Look at the U.S. reputation in the 90s. I mean, it was excellent, and look where it is today. So of course the world is going to look at it differently. So we're pushing, you know, trying to sell these fake genocides like in Xinjiang, or the Chinese are doing genocide, which is not true. And of course the Russians are trying to do genocide, which is not true. And we do the same with the Iranians. Oh, they kill tens of thousands of their own citizens, but they can't provide any evidence, no list of names. They do this, and they do the same in Ukraine. The Russians took thousands of kids. But if you ask, well, can you provide the names? Then, now you're denying it, or you're saying what Russia is saying. So it's just no one's believing it. And at the same time as all these lies are coming, we've seen that our leaders have been doing the forever wars now for decades. As you said, we backed the genocide quite enthusiastically in Gaza. Also, when they attacked Iran, you had people like Chancellor Merz saying, "Oh, the Syrians are doing our dirty work for us." The second attack, Merz is also positioned himself as the main backer of the United States. We fueled a civil war in Syria, killing hundreds of thousands, only to install an ISIS leader, which we now do everything we can with help of the media to rehabilitate. Oh, look, he's wearing a suit. He's one of us now. He's civilized. And also, the backing of fascist groups in Kiev, and where are the principles, where are the values? I don't think people are they're not buying it anymore. And so this whole, as you suggested, this new narrative now of Kallas and the rest is, why are the Russians now striking harder? Because I think they will go after the Baltic states. I think they will increase the brutality in Ukraine which will be a horrific for Ukrainians. And they're doing this because NATO has escalated over and over again over the past 4 years. And you can objectively say this. If you see the weapons they sent, the targeting, all of this, the direct involvement, all of this has escalated more and more. And the Russians always had this dilemma. Do we retaliate and risk World War III, or don't we, and embolden NATO? Now they have been too emboldened. And as you said, the Karaganov argument have won. It's time to hit back. So what does NATO say? Oh, I guess we have to restrain ourselves? No, they're saying the opposite. Oh, the Russians are being defeated. They're desperate. Now they're just lashing out. I mean, you can't...
It's exactly the wrong lesson. It's exactly the opposite lesson from what you should learn.
Yeah.
But on this part, And I will ask you about a few more questions about your guest in a moment. But one of the most surprising things to me in of this year so far is what happened with Iran. And in my reading, what Iran did is it successfully reestablished deterrence, and it successfully actually taught the US that if you strike me, then I will always at any point retain the ability to strike you back and to not only hurt you, but hurt Israel in equal amounts. So stop striking. And after 40 days, that strategy seems to have worked, although it is, we are not out of the woods. But the kinetic part of the war stopped. So Iran, with like a very also being able to absorb all of these shocks and being willing to sacrifice its leaders, and kind of managed to deal with this war of aggression in a way that I haven't seen before. Do you think that this holds any kind of lessons of how Russia can approach its war with NATO?
Yeah, no, I think this is also one of the big lessons. Well, first, I always make the point, the reason why the present time is so dangerous is because the Europeans are escalating in such a reckless way. The Americans at the same time are pulling back, handing over the war to the Europeans. So the Europeans can't rely on their support. So they're escalating, they're losing their backing. And also at the same time, Russia has to restore its deterrence. I mean, anyone with half a brain can see that this is going to result in disaster unless we do something. And of course, then, as you suggest, the Iran war comes on top, which has entirely new lessons for Russia, because Iran did not, you know, try to look the other way and hope that, you know, they would avoid escalation. No, they saw all these attacks from happening, and they showed the ability to go up that escalation ladder with the United States. And it's exactly because they went up the escalation ladder that America has become more cautious. I mean, why aren't the Americans burning down all of the energy facilities across Iran? Well, it's one reason. If they do this, then the Iranians will retaliate and they will burn down all the energy infrastructure, the desalination plant across the Gulf states, and essentially make these countries unlivable, turning them back into deserts. So it's because they're willing to escalate that the Americans aren't going all the way. So now they're sitting in Russia going, what have we been doing for the past 4 years? Because we restrained ourselves, and we can read the Western newspapers. They're saying that our restraint was weakness. We're too afraid of NATO. NATO can launch missiles at our capital, and we don't dare to do anything in return. And also, they look towards the Baltic states now, as the Baltic states are involved in attacks on Russia. They're saying, what did Iran do? Well, when the Americans attacked, the Iranians looked, where are the attacks coming from? They're coming from the Gulf states. So they attacked, and they did attack the UAE, they attacked Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, anyone who participated in the attack are now participants in the war, and they are legitimate targets. The Russians didn't do this towards the Baltic states, so the lesson now is, well, perhaps we should have gone down the Iranian route. And, you know, and it's hard to, you know, it's easy to see the logic there. And it would be as if, you know, when America went into, you know, kidnap Maduro, if the Russians and Chinese would then send missiles to Venezuela and start raining missiles on Washington, would Washington say this is, oh no, this is merely a Venezuelan attack? You know, no. Or if you would turn it the other way, if Canada would host Iranian missiles to launch at American cities, and then Canada would say, oh, no, we're just, you know, we're a neutral country. We just, you know, happen to have our airspace used by the Iranians. No, this would never, you know, this is a ridiculous argument. So of course, the Gulf states participate in this. Not only did they allow it, but we also now heard that they lobbied very hard for the U.S., especially the UAE and Saudi Arabia, to attack Iran. So they are participants. And if Iran wants to have any deterrent, they have to strike against those who attack them. And this is the lesson now in Russia, which is should be common sense. But if you say it, then they say, well, then you're supporting it. You're legitimizing it. You're encouraging attacks on Europe. Now, you know, they have to come after you as a person. It's this is the new Europe. This is why, again, the frog is boiling here. There is no point for common sense can come in.
But the sick thing is, it seems to me that that's what they want. It's like they're also telling the European population the Russians will attack the Baltic states because Vladimir Putin is the new Hitler and he will run over the entirety of Europe. And now they're creating a situation in which Russia has the only option left, which is to actually attack them. So, you create a self-fulfilling prophecy where then the attacks that will come on the European land, on NATO territory, will come as an affirmation of what they said before, which then only will galvanize the populations behind war with Russia. So it's they're kind of the logic of that we are in makes war, and a very horrible war, all but inevitable, it seems to me. Or do you still see a way out?
No, I'm not sure how I see a way out anymore. I mean, we've gone so far into this now that it's very hard to reverse. But the logic, as you said, is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. That this is when NATO, since the Orange Revolution was in 2004, was pushing for pulling Ukraine into the NATO orbit. The argument was always, well, the Ukrainians need to be defended from Russia. However, the Russians weren't making any threats, any claims to Ukraine. Barely 20, as NATO recognized back then, only 20% of Ukrainians actually wanted to be part of NATO. Most favored cooperation with Russia. So we wanted to help them so much, even if they didn't want it, and there was no threats against them. But then, of course, once we topple the government in Kiev and then begins to empower the far-right extremists and pump in more weapons, build up a proxy armies, attack Donbass, then, of course, now you have a Russian threat. And so you create a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I said the same with the Baltic states. The idea that the Russians would, once they're finished with Ukraine, they're going to go and attack or annex the Baltic states. I said, it's nonsense. They're not going to attack the Baltic states. That makes no sense at all. They were responding to what they saw as an existential security threat coming from Ukraine. But it's not nonsense anymore. After we're doing long-range strikes into Russia using NATO territory, then the Baltic states and probably Finland to attack Russia. Yeah, now I assume an attack will come on the Baltic states. It's more likely than not. So as you said, it creates this these self-fulfilling prophecies. I remember even James Baker used this argument in an article he wrote in 2000 in response to NATO expansion. He said, well, why are we expanding NATO? There's no Russian threat. We said there might be one in the future. Was saying the obvious thing. If we expand NATO, Russia will see this as a threat. They will take countermeasures, and then we'll have our self-fulfilling prophecy. This was the argument of Kennan and many others. So this is what we do. And the problem is, because this is what we do, we're stuck in narrative. You say, what can we do to get out of this? Nothing, because we committed ourselves to narrative that we're only defending ourselves. This is a Russian imperialist expansionist motivation. Nothing is happening because of what we have done. So how can we pull back when we can't even recognize that we've done anything wrong? So it's the like, Finnish, yeah, sorry.
It's like an alcoholic then you needing another sip from the bottle in the morning just to get up. It's like you need the very thing that's wrecking you and ruining you in order to somehow stay afloat. Because if the Europeans actually changed their tune, they would have to admit that they got it backwards, right? And that's the last thing any one of them will do.
Yeah, well, this is the new radicalism I see, because anyone studying international security and international relations know that the point of departure in assessing conflicts is what's referred to as the international anarchy. Of all these states, they all compete for security and power. So, for example, China develops some new missiles to be safe. That will be insecurity for the Americans. They will develop more missiles. That will be insecurity for the Russians. This is the security competition. However, I saw the Finnish foreign minister speak, was it 2-3 days ago? And she was making the point that, NATO is not a threat to Russia, but Russia is a threat not just to us, but to world peace. But if this is how you view the world, is good guys and bad guys, our missiles are good, their missiles are bad, you can't reduce the security competition. What has always been recognized as creating peace is putting ourselves in the shoes of the other side, seeking compromise. You can't do that because, as they say, the idea that the world's largest military bloc is established against Russia, seeking now to create bring together all of Europe except the largest country in Europe, which is Russia. Obviously this creates zero-sum logic. It revives the mentality of the Cold War. And yet, NATO's not a threat to Russia. That's it. Just a blanket statement. There's nothing to discuss here. Move on. And, you know, we will continue to expand. We will do our illegal interventionism everywhere. We will interfere in Russia's domestic affairs. We'll surround the country with military infrastructure, missiles. We'll arm crazy anti-Russian fascist groups. We'll do anything it takes. But if the Russians say that this somehow undermines their security, it's madness. And if you, as an EU citizen, would say it, then you would be, you know, you would be smeared, you would be canceled. You can even be sanctioned. I mean, this is where we are. It's how can you then reverse course when this is what we do?
I mean, you're being smeared. Luckily, you haven't been sanctioned yet, but two of my compatriots have been sanctioned, Jacques Beau and Nathalie Yamb, for basically opposing, Nathalie Yamb for opposing European and especially French colonialism, and our colleague Jacques Beau for basically working on the historical precedents of the entire Ukraine war, right? Working it up and out. But this is, it's such a scary moment.
Yeah. Well, this is it. Usually, you know, the strength we often had in the West, you know, we have open societies. We do, you know, you're able to criticize the government and their policies. And in order to do so, we can do course correction. If you're pursuing a foolish policy that doesn't maximize their security, you can have some opposition to it. But there's no opposition. And I mean, look where we are. We're heading down with destroying Ukraine. We're heading down a possibility of a nuclear war with Russia. And then you have people like Jacques Beau, who's making the argument that, you know, this is a very dangerous path. We need to maybe change course. And, you know, for people who are not familiar with him, he's a retired colonel in the Swiss army. He was working in Swiss intelligence. He worked with NATO you know, he's just the most prolific author there is. But the thing is, he made the mistake of essentially having the wrong conclusion. He argued that, well, NATO also contributed to this. And when he says that, it's not because, you know, he's on the payroll of the Kremlin. It's because if you want to make a compromise and end the war, you also have to recognize where you have contributed. But how did the EU respond to this? What did it do to a colonel in the Swiss intelligence? They sanctioned him. They cut off his money, his bank. He's not allowed to leave Brussels. He's a prisoner there. And how did this happen? You know, was he found guilty of anything? No, there was no day in court. There was nothing. Just one day you wake up, your name is on the list of someone who has done wrong thing. And now, you know, you're under this horrific sanctions and, you know, people aren't even allowed to give him money because then they would be in breach of sanctions. This is the new Europe. This is what, you know, is a dishonesty and continuous warfare does to you.
You and I, we both interviewed Matthias Desmet, right? Probably the most important thinker and professor of psychology who's been working on mass formations for the best part of his career. He made the argument that, you know, this is it. I mean, Europe is in a mass formation, and the mass formation is basically an ideology that is then like festering and starts, you know, also kicking out any kind of non-conformist parts of society, and it gets worse and worse. What do you make out of that argument? There are a couple of other psychologists who say, like, no, mass psychology is not really a thing. You're kind of imagining, you're seeing things where there are, you're seeing patterns where it's just coincidence. But it seems to me that that's a very strong argument, that we are actually in some sort of mass psychological phenomenon, that the entirety of the continent at the moment is working itself further and further in.
Well, it's a very strange argument to argue that this is not a real thing, because you know, whether you look at psychology or sociology, a key focus has always been the duality of a man. You know, we are rational individuals, but we're also group animals. We organize in group for meaning, security, and this is how human beings organize. And based on this, you have key psychologists like Sigmund Freud, who came up with the concept of group psychology. And, you know, they've done tons of experiments. That is, if you have where they put down groups of 10 people, they ask the people, why, what did you just see? And, you know, it's easy to remember, you know, that the individual knows what he saw, but if the nine other people say something else, then that one individual will fall in line. This is human nature. We adopt to the group to some extent. So you always have the balance between rational individual and the irrational instinctive group psychology that Sigmund Freud pointed to. Now, I often make the point that the nephew of Sigmund Freud, Edward Bernays, he essentially took these ideas and made theories about how to do how to manipulate people. In other words, how to use how to appeal to the irrational aspect of people by manipulating group psychology. This is the foundational literature on political propaganda. If you go through the books of Bernays, what political propaganda entails, and then you listen to the way our politicians speak, what our media is writing, this demand for mass conformity around all ideas that, you know, one side is good, one is evil. It's ridiculous. There's nothing rational there anymore. We abandoned rationality a long, long time ago. So the idea, no, so I very much agree with, what Desmet has written and what he's saying.
You know, me too. It's just, I wonder how we can use these insights now in order to, we cannot do this again. We cannot have a third or a fourth war with Russia in 200 years. If it is indeed the case that the European populations and the European countries and within NATO and the entire dynamic that has developed is leading to a mass formation and to a mass psychosis, then how can we help Russia and China and whoever else might be interested in helping us avoid millions of deaths to kind of treat that patient? I mean, it's just so hard to accept that warfare with Russia, and again, a couple of million deaths on the continent is the only thing that will get us over it. Is there any epiphany that you had in the recent past of what needs to be done?
Well, that was kind of my motivation for, because I work just, as a professor at the university, but that was my motivation for starting a podcast, because I see the mass conformity. There's no dissent in the media. I often point to this country, what has happened here, because once the Russians invaded Ukraine, our prime minister said, oh, there's no way we're going to send weapons. Norway don't send weapons to countries at war. And now, of course, he's flipped, but also every single member of parliament is for sending weapons. Not a single one is arguing for actually having diplomacy at all. So this is the new thing. Weapons are the path to peace and diplomacy is appeasement. And not just every politician, all the media outlets and anyone who tries to say, well, why shouldn't we talk to the other side? Well, then, you are an agent of the Kremlin, essentially. You're repeating Kremlin talking points, only ad hominem attacks, nothing of substance. This is the new normal. So this is kind of my thoughts. So what can you do? I think the main answer, if you look at the literature on propaganda, especially written on the 1930s up to the 1950s, a lot of good stuff came out. They always made the point that if propaganda and this mass psychosis is about the group psychology, that is the rationality is suppressed in favor of these tricks of manipulating the group mentality. They said that the main objective then should be to have open debate. You should have Churchill debating Stalin. Get it out in the open, have open discussions. And they always warned the opposite is calling for censorship, because censorship is a form of propaganda. If you say, oh, the other side is doing propaganda, we have to censor them. This is propaganda. You don't fight propaganda with censorship. This is nonsense. But this is the new logic. This is, no one knows contesting it. But the same with the idea that, the propaganda is what propaganda means, because after, the Germans used their, propaganda in the First World War, the propaganda got a dirty name. So we didn't even call it propaganda anymore. We began to call it, public relations. And the thing is, the main point was always, well, authoritarian states do propaganda, not democracies. But that's completely wrong. I mean, Bernays, Walter Lippmann, all the original scholars who developed the theories on political propaganda made the point that democracies are more dependent. The more liberal democratic you are, the more you're reliant on propaganda, because you know, for example, in Britain, when they expanded the voting rights, you had to complement this because, well, now you're all these people who might not, you know, do what you want. So now there's more need. If you transfer sovereignty from the government to the people, then someone has to manage the opinions of the people. So the idea that democracies, or we democracies, we don't do propaganda, it doesn't make any sense. And literally, they often do it much, much better as well. This is another study on propaganda throughout the Cold War. You know, source credibility is quite important. That is, a message is more convincing if it comes from a source of you think that they're benign, altruistic, and you know. But if you're state media, you're not very convincing at all. Everyone knows who you are, and they know your motivations. Then, if you have other motivations. The reason why the West did better political propaganda throughout the Cold War is because we could launder it through NGOs, through private businesses. That we could, we do the same today. This is why Western governments spend billions on NGOs, because they're essentially acting as propaganda arms of the government, but they have the source credibility of being about human rights, even though they work hand in hand with intelligence services, even though they get all their money from the government. It's, yeah, this is propaganda, but people, you know, I tried once to criticize think tanks which are funded by, you know, CIA cutouts like National Endowment for Democracies, and had letters written to my university that I'm attacking civil society because NGOs are civil society now. I mean, this is this is where we are. It's beyond insane.
Yeah, and you as a university professor are not supposed to criticize anyone who's in favor of more warfare. I mean, it's just such an insane moment, and I keep wondering if there's nothing that can be done to take away this this playing field of NATO, which is Ukraine. If Ukraine was not at war with Russia, then all of these excuses to like fire into Russia would be gone, right? Do you think that this is going through their minds, like how to end the Ukraine war in a way that then, you know, there's no state of war officially. I mean, also from the Russian side, it's a special military operation. So for very sick reasons, like we have on both sides kind of an interest in pretending that this is not what it actually is. But if this war was ended and Russia is getting closer and closer to actually fully occupying the entirety of the Donbas, which in my understanding is what is more or less the war goal, and then create a buffer and a security zone. But do you see any hope in the way that things are developing on the battlefield that maybe this launching pad for Europe's aggression into Russia can be taken off the playing field?
Well, that's what could put an end to this war, because I always make the point that the war in Ukraine, it reflects a much larger phenomenon. That is, after the Cold War, you know, we actually had agreements with Russia to develop an inclusive common European security architecture, so we would overcome the bloc politics of the Cold War. You know, this is what we agreed with the Charter of Paris for a new Europe in 1990. This is why we established the OSCE in 1994, which was actually an inclusive security architecture. But this, when we decided to expand NATO, this was because we decided instead to go for hegemonic peace, and the one which would push Russia out. And that's what we've been doing. And this is kind of the commonality in the conflict between the Russians, also war against economic war against China, also war against Iran. It's the West, the distribution of power has shifted. It's not only one central power, and the entire security architecture has to change. And the expansion of NATO was the main manifestation of this unipolar moment, that is the collective hegemony of Europe. Now, this has been balanced and pushed back. So the problem of getting a peace agreement in Ukraine is that the war isn't only about Ukraine. It's about the European security architecture. That is, we have to have it's a foundational security. It can't just be to have security against Russia, max deterrence, undermine its stability. It has to be one that takes into account the security concerns of all. I mean, this was considered to be one of the achievements after World War II. That is, you got the French the Germans into the same European coal and steel community. So you would seek security with each other instead of against each other. This is what we should have done after the Cold War. But we had instead a hegemonic peace. The hegemon is gone. And now you have to adjust to new reality. So And there's some recognition of this. General Keith Kellogg, Russophobe, if there ever was one, he also stated in an interview once that, okay, but when we get a, if we get a peace agreement in Ukraine, it always also have to include, like, what do we do with Moldova and Georgia? Because we can't just fight there as well. And this was kind of the problem. When we began to expand NATO, gradually goes to the east. What happens, you know, Poland was not that difficult because every Pole there is wanted to be a part of NATO. There was no sympathies to Russia. But when it came to these countries with deeply divided societies, be it Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, what will happen? Well, they're split in the middle. So you're going to then trigger civil war and conflict. And then, of course, the great powers will come in and use them as puppets against each other. So this is, you know, what happened in Ukraine can play out in other other parts of Europe as well, which is why we need a wider agreement. But of course, if the Ukraine war comes to an end, then there might be a big opening to change the security architecture. And I, you know, something good could come from this, but at this point, it looks more likely that we're going to end up in a massive war.
What do you make out of Brian Beletic's argument that, you know, it's overall still within the system design that the United States is now working on what is it called? Like the division of labor that Europe is now basically going to be responsible for a full-fledged war against Russia, while the US is going to try to use the Gulf states and Israel. I mean, he's one of the few people who thinks that the United States is abusing Israel to fight a war with Iran. While, and then it itself is then going to gear up now pretty soon, I think, under that construct for a full-fledged war with China. How realistic do you think that is, maybe not only as a concept, but also with the new distribution of power, seeing, for instance, that both in Russia and in Israel, Iran, it seems that the Western war coalition run against two walls, not just one.
Yeah, no, again, this has been one of my disappointments about the Trump administration, because when he came in, he very much spoke in the language of, the audience he was attracting was were the people in America who said, listen, the hegemonic peace is over. We can't, you know, sacrifice the republic to prolong the empire. We have to, you know, do the opposite, and we have to adjust to new realities. And Marco Rubio, if you remember, right after the Trump administration came to power again, he made this interview with Megyn Kelly, and he was arguing that, you know, unipolarity is a very unusual abnormality. It's, you know, this is gone now. We have a multipolar system. We have to get used to this. The way at the time I interpreted was, okay, what do you do if you adjust to a multipolar distribution of power? Well, America can't be everywhere, so probably we'll have to pivot to focus on the Western Hemisphere, focus more on East Asia, where its peer rival China is. In other words, you have to start to pivot out of Europe and Middle East. So, you know, it's reasonable to expect that they would draw down their forces. But then you began to see some changes, and more, instead of ending, for example, the Ukraine war, you get the impression that they're just outsourcing it. And this is Eldridge Colby. He made this speech, which I thought was, it showed exactly why how the thinking was, which was, listen, the Europeans have to arm themselves. More weapons. You have to be able to give more to the Ukrainians to confront the Russians. So essentially they're handing over the war against Russia to the Europeans. A bit like they did now in the Middle East. They're looking for, you know, who can fight the Iranians? Do we have any Kurdish groups or any groups in Pakistan that can be used? How about some Iraqis? We can use the Gulf states. How about the Israelis? So, and of course, if you're going to fight China, you don't fight them with Americans. You would try to use Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. This is why you have frontline states. If you're a stable, confident hegemon, such as the US was in the 90s, then being a frontline state can be quite lucrative. They will look after your security, you will have stability. Again, the Americans were the only game in town. When you have a declining hegemon, what do you do? Well, then it's time to cash in on these frontline states. That is, you know, they should go and fight and die. They should all essentially be Kurds. They should all be Ukrainians to fight to the last man to weaken your adversaries. And that's, I think, there's a reasonable argument that, you know, you can see this is what's being done.
In a very bizarre way, the U.S. empire is going through a similar process as some of the large some of the large apps on its IT platform, a process that a lot of people call enshittification, where everything that you once used to get for free is now gonna be up for a lot of payment and much more pain until the system like squeezes itself out and squeezes itself dry. So it's that kind of stage of imperial decline, isn't it?
Yes, but I think that if the US was going to do this, they're essentially too late. And I see this because the US can try to strangle other rising powers, with economic or military force. But they seem to both be failing. That is, in the economic area, they can do many things. They can cut off countries from key technologies and industries. And you saw them doing this, for example, with the Chinese. They had this great idea. Let's cut them off the semiconductors and then China will begin to unravel. But instead, it was too late. The Chinese can suddenly, very quickly make their own semiconductors. They can have their own technological sovereignty. They can decouple from the US and still thrive. Well, you can also do other things. You can cut our countries off from physical transportation corridors. And they do this, every now and then they hijack the Iranian tankers even before the war. They could put blockades on Cuba, on Venezuela. They can now also try to put in a gradual blockade, with the Europeans on the front line in the Baltic Sea, by essentially putting sanctions on Russian ships and then labeling them shadow fleet. So now apparently it sounds legal that they are being seized and hijacked on the open sea. So, you can also do this, but then you see the Chinese, the Russians, they're all building up a quite formidable army to push back against this. Also, the Chinese, the Russians have been building these Eurasian transportation corridors, which is why they're becoming less dependent on U.S. controlled naval corridors. And of course, last you have the financial leg, that is, they can cut countries off, banks, currencies, all of this. And this is why they thought that the Russian economy would collapse by the end of the week when they did this in 2022. But instead, it only fuels the new parallel international financial system. That is, the Chinese, Russians, they're building new development banks, new payment systems, alternatives to SWIFT. They're beginning to trade more and more in their own currencies. They're dropping the US bonds. So all of this is becoming counterproductive. So it's not working, and if the economic war fails, then you lean into the actual war. Even there, we saw which is why it was so critical what the Iranians did. They defeated the Americans. There's nothing the Americans can do now. And in Ukraine, the Russians will come on top. They will win, and this will likely break up NATO as well. So there's only escalation. Either they have two options: either accept a transitioning into a multipolar system where you recognize that your opponents also have security concerns. In other words, security can't be based on the overwhelming dominance of the US that everyone has to fall in line. Instead, you have to recognize and mitigate the security concerns of your opponents as well. Either you do this or you try to restore dominance through a massive war. And I think we're leaning towards the latter, unfortunately.
Yeah, we are. I mean, the one litmus test to me whether they're finally changing is when they're going to start changing their tune toward this idea of like neutral spaces. A neutral Ukraine would have self-saved the entire thing even in 2022. So too can neutral spaces still now, but even all until now, there's nothing like that. There's no bridge building. Maybe just a very last point, though. We started off with realism and this mother of all problems, that in during the unipolar moment there was nothing to constrain power. Now there is, right? There's just like effectively there are these walls, and we've had this quite fascinating article the other week from Robert Kagan, Pope of neocons, who actually said like, well, this is it. We lost the Iran war decisively, and this is quite surprising for somebody like him. Then again, he doesn't call for de-escalation. Rather says like if anything can say it, it's more escalation. But still, do you think that we are getting to the point where maybe the physical constraints finally start becoming clear, because even the production capacities of the US and Europe just don't suffice anymore to wage all of that warfare left and right? Yes, you can still implement a genocide in a concentration camp in Palestine, but these other wars are completely different games.
Well, in the realist theory, though, I think it's the expected trajectory of the political West was because states are not—they're not necessarily power maximizers; they're security maximizer. And the difference is when you're balanced, then you would stop trying to expand. And so, what I would expect after the Cold War would be for the political West to just begin to expand in every direction. That is, expand NATO, go to war against the. So many wars by now, until they're balanced, be it by China, Russia, Iran. And once you're balanced, then you stop expanding. And then you essentially seek a new status quo. And that's kind of what the rational state would do. The problem is that I don't think we're all that rational anymore, because we've had essentially more than three decades of a political class raised on the idea that we essentially transcended history. This is the end of, Fukuyama's end of history. Because our hegemony allows us to pursue a liberal peace, we elevate the role of liberal democracy, human rights. And so, they essentially saw their dominance as making the world better, crossing that bridge from the flawed world of the past to this new brave world of tomorrow, of perpetual peace. So this is kind of what I think is the source of the irrationality. So Realist theory would assume, but realist theory assumed that the state is rational, and they would assume that once you're balanced, you would stop, and then you would accept a new status quo. That is, you don't have to like it, but there's nothing you can do. For example, in the Middle East, the Iranians are there. If you don't recognize their security, don't take their security into account, in other words, stop the crippling sanctions, perpetual military threat, they will shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and they will acquire it on their own. If you don't respect the Russian security, they will push back. If you don't respect the Chinese, they will push back. So in other words, it's in our interest now to take into account. We've been balanced. This is what would be a rational decision. But this is where my concern is, that I'm a more neoclassical realist. That is, I look at the decision makers as an intervening variable, essentially between the international distribution of power and foreign policy. So if they have block loyalties, dependencies in fighting, institutional commitments or ideology that makes them not act rationally, then you're in very, very deep trouble. Yeah. I read an old one from Henry Kissinger this morning, actually, from March of 2014, just to make this point of the rationality. He wrote then, I have it here, this is March 2014. That is, the month after the after the coup, and as the Russians were going to seize Crimea. And he writes, far too often the Ukrainian issue is posed as a showdown, whether Ukraine joins the East or the West. But if Ukraine is to survive and thrive, it must not be either side's outpost against the other. It should function as a bridge between them. The West is largely Catholic. The East is largely Russian Orthodox. The West speaks Ukrainian. The East mostly speak Russian. Any attempt by one wing of Ukraine to dominate the other, as has been the pattern, would lead eventually to civil war or breakup. To treat Ukraine as a part of an East-West confrontation would scuttle for decades and any prospect to bring Russia and the West, especially Russia and Europe, into a cooperative international system. So again, this was rational thinking. And when he made this argument in 2014, that makes sense. We should avoid making it a frontline state. Again, this is a problem of bloc politics. How do we avoid this? Try to say this today, if you're a politician, a journalist, an academic, that you shouldn't make Ukraine a frontline state. Oh, well, then you're taking the side of the aggressor. You're blaming the victim. It's a Kremlin talking point. There's no room for any sensible discussion anymore. It's only good versus evil. Make sure you sit in the trenches with us. Otherwise, you're part of the evil and you're the enemy. So I think the rationality now in the West is a huge problem for us to avoid massive war.
Realism only works in a rational world. However, we will need to continue talking about this and analyzing it, because I still have to hope that in the end something shows up that will allow us to avoid the worst. And I would just like to point everybody to your channel, Glenn. Like everybody, I suppose you know, because I think the overlap of our viewership is quite high. So, but if you haven't seen Glenn before, I mean, go to his channel, Glenn Deason, well, over half a million subscribers, fantastic channel, wonderful guests, like really with the most important ones as well, including, of course, Mr. Karaganov, who we already talked about, including Glenn Deason, Mr. Maran, including Larry Johnson, Jeffrey Sachs, Marandi, Scott Ritter, you know, really the who is who of modern international relations is on Glenn's channel. Glenn, any other place where people should go to find you?
I'm also on Substack, Twitter. Actually, I have a lot of other ones as well, like from Spotify, Rumble. Also on Twitter, on YouTube, I have, translated language channels for those who don't understand English well. So, mostly it will be YouTube and Substack.
Glenn Deason, thank you so much for your time today.